have evidence to show that the Clinton Global Initiative provide cover for African dictators while Americans do not know. And it makes it hard for Americans to even know that this individual is a warlord, is a criminal who has blood on their hand, because when you see him on TV, when you see him invited in Washington or in New York for the Clinton Global Initiative, you will never think that this individual has committed crimes.
I'm really outraged by everything that has been going on. Women being buried alive, women being raped to the point where their reproductive organ is being destroyed. 6 million people being killed. I mean, you just have to ask yourself, why is this not the breaking news on all the media platforms, all the international media? Why is the whole world not focusing on this?
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. Today we'll be looking abroad to the Congo and to Haiti, but also tying in the connection to our surreal domestic politics. So this week marks the 20th anniversary of the 1996 invasion of the Congo by soldiers and mercenaries from Rwanda and Uganda, many of whom were war criminals exported from the Rwandan genocide in 1994. Since then, up to 10 million Congolese people have been murdered in their mineral-rich homeland, where it is estimated that $27 trillion worth of gold, diamonds, copper, cobalt, uranium, tin, and coltan is under the ground. Coltan is used for our mobile phones, tablets, laptops, flat-screen TVs, and other electronics. In addition to these mass killings, up to 1 million women, girls, boys, and some men have survived rape and other forms of sexualized brutality that have maimed or sterilized them for life. This is also Congo Week, an international action designed to draw urgent attention to this genocide in the Congo. We'll be speaking with Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, Maurice Carney, an organizer for Congo Week. Gerald Horn is in the house, tying in Haiti to our discussion today. And this week was also a very important week for the movement for Palestinian rights. And perhaps we'll actually get a chance to talk to the campaign to end the Israeli occupation, which actually has a new name now. So as always, we have a lot packed into our hour, and we'll get started with our headlines. The 20th anniversary of the invasion of the Congo was marked with a day-long conference on Saturday in New York City that highlighted the role of the United States and transnational corporations in maintaining a system of war and chaos that has killed millions of people. Journalist Milton Alamadi expressed how the lives of millions of Congolese have not mattered to the international realm of news or geopolitics.
Congo's estimated resource, known resources, is $26 trillion, with a T. That is what is known. It could be double, it could be 50. So for that price, the West is willing to ignore the lives of, somebody said 6 million was an undercount. That the more accurate figure is probably 10, because 6 million was in 2006. Can you imagine? And yet we hear about Aleppo on a daily basis. And that's not to say we don't value the lives of Syrians and Syrian children. Of course we do. So we're familiar with the bombing in Aleppo on a daily basis. But what does that say about the value that we attach to the lives of Africans? That is the question that needs to be answered, right? Think about that. 10 million Africans dead. Many of you were not even probably familiar, and you are the informed, and that's why you came here. What about the rest of the country? People who are less informed. Think about that. And U.S. policymakers are aware of that and yet keep silence. Why doesn't the U.S. have allies? Why don't we get the First Lady tweeting something about the Congolese as well? Think about that. Is it because that might conflict with the U.S. agenda in the region? Think about that.
The conference was in downtown Manhattan. We'll have more about the Congo and Congo Week after headlines. In Black Lives Matter news in the U.S., New Yorkers are protesting the fatal police shooting of Deborah Danner, a 66-year-old African-American woman who was killed by a New York Police Department sergeant on Tuesday. Danner suffered from schizophrenia and police knew that she was mentally ill when they shot and killed her in her own home in the Bronx after a neighbor called 911. Police said they found Danner naked in her bedroom holding a pair of scissors. Authorities say Sergeant Hugh Barry fatally shot her after she picked up a baseball bat. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio called the fatal shooting unacceptable.
Deborah Danner, 66 years old, and known to the NYPD as someone who suffered from mental illness. And the shooting of Deborah Danner is tragic and it is unacceptable. It should never have happened. It's as simple as that. It should never have happened.
Sergeant Hugh Barry has been sued twice in recent years for brutality. On Tuesday night, dozens of Deborah Danner's neighbors rallied in the Bronx to demand justice for her. The ACLU is trying to get justice in Flint, Michigan for school children who are suffering the effects of lead poisoning but are not getting the special education that they need. This week, the ACLU filed a class action civil rights lawsuit. Carrie Moss, executive director of ACLU Michigan, told reporters that the suit documents ongoing violations of federal education laws by the state of Michigan and local school authorities.
Given that lead is a known neurotoxin that causes cognitive, developmental, and behavioral impairment in children, it's imperative that the schools be prepared and equipped to provide critical services to these children.
According to the lawsuit, nearly 30,000 Flint school children from birth to age 19 have been exposed to high levels of lead both at home and in school, and that these children are being denied their right to a free and appropriate education. During the 2014 to 2015 school year, the suspension expulsion rate for special education students in Flint community schools was more than five times higher than the rate for special education students in all Michigan school districts. And because of the ongoing concern over the impact on water, the controversy over the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline is continuing, and the organization Food and Water Watch is mounting a petition campaign to tell the Department of Justice to block a merger between two of the largest oil and gas infrastructure companies. Enbridge, a major backer of the pipeline, and Spectra are set to merge, creating the largest oil and gas infrastructure company in North America. Enbridge, along with Phillips 66, Energy Transfer Partners, Sunco Logistics, and Marathon, are behind the scenes of the Bakken Pipeline, which includes the Dakota Access Pipeline, and are banking on a massive payoff at the community's expense. Food and Water Watch says that the Enbridge-Spectra merger strengthens big oil and big gas's ability to keep us tied to a dirty fossil fuel past. You can find the petition at fwwatch.org. That's fwwatch.org. Finally, in culture and media, there are lots of films about Congo on YouTube, and we can speak to Maurice Carney about those that you can check out during Congo Week. And they include films about the history of the Congo, including the history of King Leopold's atrocities, the history of Patrice Lumumba, and today's mass killings. Now, tonight, the Hurston Wright Literary Awards are here in D.C., honoring black writers in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. And our own geopolitical analyst, Gerald Horn, is nominated for a book that we have actually discussed many times on the show, Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. And he's in studio today with us before going to the awards program. Good morning, Gerald.
Well, good morning to you.
Now, in your book, you detail this very complex and fascinating history about Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and the role of the United States. And I can't help but think that it's a story still being told in terms of the U.S. Backing a coup in Haiti in recent years. And, of course, the role of the Clinton Foundation in Haiti, which is one area where Clinton really faltered in this week's presidential debate. And, of course, there's a link to Congo, which we'll be talking about later. So tying all that together, what are your thoughts about the election and the connection to Haiti?
Well, even a stop clock is right twice a day. And Donald J. Trump made a fair point when he suggested that when he went to Little Haiti and South Florida just the other day, that there's a lot of animosity and antipathy towards Hillary Rodham Clinton, not least because of how her and her brother and the Clinton Foundation have systematically plundered and looted Haiti in the wake and the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake. Now, this should only come as a surprise to those who have not been paying attention. What I mean is that, as some of my history books have tried to show, the United States itself was built on a foundation of untrammeled animosity towards people of African descent. That's why we, our ancestors, were enslaved. But it was the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, that upset their apple cart, because it led to a general crisis of the entire slave system that could only be resolved with its collapse. And the empire struck back in 1844 when it split the island, leading to the independence of the Dominican Republic and decades of hostility that continues to persist between the two nations that share the island of Hispaniola, that is to say, Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And then there's the Congo connection, not only insofar as many of we Africans on this side of the Atlantic of Congolese descent, whether we know it or not, but there's a story waiting to be told about how Haitians traveled to Africa in the wake of independence, particularly in French-speaking former colonies such as Congo Brazzaville, Congo Kinshasa in particular, and contributed skills as mathematicians, as physicians, as engineers, etc. And it's one of the more stirring episodes of Pan-African solidarity that have yet to be articulated, at least in a comprehensive manner.
Well, I'm sure that you'll be, I can expect at some point you'll be looking into it the way you describe it.
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll be actually talking about the Congo and those kind of connections later, but as you look today at this 20th anniversary of the invasion of the Congo, it really only is the latest plunder, you know, rape and pillage, you know, of that country. And in terms of the United States relationship to that, what do you consider in terms of this anniversary?
Well, the historians are just beginning to tackle the fact that after the United States was founded in the late 18th century, it became the mastermind of the international slave trade in Africans. And one of its major targets was the Congo. In fact, as late as 1860, on the eve of the U.S. Civil War, there were hundreds of Congolese being smuggled into Galveston, Texas, for example, to work as enslaved laborers on various plantations in southeast Texas. The travails of the Congo continue because of the diplomatic support extended by the United States to Belgium, the colonial power in the Congo. Keep in mind that at the same time, the United States had a systematic practice of collaboration with the Belgians in keeping black Americans out of the Congo. Not only making sure that they didn't have passports, but then collaborating with the Belgians to making sure they could not get visas to travel to the Congo, because we were seen as, understandably, as seditious forces. And then, of course, there's the well-documented episode of U.S. Complicity in the murder of Patrice Lumumba, the first leader, of independent Congo post 1960. And Larry Devlin, a former CIA agent, has written about this at some length, about the CIA's direct complicity in the murder of Patrice Lumumba and the continuing plunder of the Congo because of its vast natural resources, which you mentioned in your opening introduction.
So this is the type of in-depth information that Gerald Horn provides in his book, Confronting Black Jacobins. And we actually have that. First of all, we should say that this is the book that's been nominated for this Hurston Wright Award that's being given out tonight. And the program is tonight. The Hurston Wright Awards are tonight here in D.C. And his book, Confronting Black Jacobins, is one of the books nominated. So those are headlines and happenings. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the Congo and what does not make the news. Stay with us.
This one is dedicated to all the women in the world. Women in North America, South America, Asia, Australia, Europe.
Was Anna Mulago, Women of the World. And this week marks the 20th anniversary, as I said at the opening of the show, of the 1996 invasion of the Congo by soldiers and mercenaries from Rwanda and Uganda, many of whom were war criminals exported from the Rwandan genocide in 1994. Since then, up to 10 million Congolese have been murdered in their mineral-rich homeland, where it is estimated that $27 trillion worth of gold, diamonds, copper, cobalt, uranium, tin, and coltan is buried underneath the ground. Coltan is the element that is used for our mobile phones, tablets, laptops, flat screen TVs, and other electronics. In addition to these mass killings, up to 1 million women, girls, boys, and some men have survived rape and other forms of sexualized brutality, and that they've been maimed or sterilized for life. This is also Congo Week, and an international action designed to draw urgent attention to this genocide in the Congo. Joining us via Skype is Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, Maurice Carney, an organizer for Congo Week. Good morning, Maurice.
Good morning. Good morning, Esther. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for joining me.
I would also like to say hello to Professor Horn. We've shared a panel a couple years ago back in Los Angeles, so it's good to be on with him.
Ditto.
So I've laid out some of the bitter facts about what has happened in the Congo, but it seems like there's never too much information. And I think that we have to kind of, within the time limit that we have, kind of start at the beginning for our listeners at the point 20 years ago that this anniversary is marking, you know, what happened to get the Congo to this point, the most recent events. And it seems that this one excuse for the ongoing ignoring of these atrocities is it because people are saying, oh, this is just Africans killing Africans, and it's billed as an ethnic conflict. So if you could just give us some background and bring us up to date.
Sure. A host of reasons for the lack of attention around the situation in the Congo, where millions have lost their lives, and the United Nations says the conflict there that began in 1996 is the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II. We posit that there are several reasons, at least, for the lack of focus and attention, and really not just from the world media, but also from Pan-Africanists, folks who champion Black lives. Progressive folks who confront U.S. foreign policy throughout the globe. Really, Esther, across the board, the battle that's unfolded in the heart of Africa and the tragedies that have been committed have occurred in relative obscurity. Really, there is what's unfolding is a battle for the heart of Africa. European dominance on the African continent has always centered the Congo. Now, the Congo was at the center of the carving up of the continent in 1884 and 1885 when European nations established their spheres of influence in what was called the Berlin Conference, is also called the Congo Conference. When the United States wanted to control the post-independence African nations, the first country post-independence African country that the U.S. intervened in was the Congo in 1960. Larry Devlin, whom Professor Horn referenced a little earlier in his book, Chief of Station Congo, because he was the CIA Chief of Station in the Congo, so he titled his book that, he said that we had to overthrow Lumumba. because if we did not overthrow Lumumba, not only would we have lost the Congo, but we would have lost all of Africa. So he centers Congo in U.S. Foreign relations, foreign policy, in terms of his dominance of the African continent. And at that time, according to recently published declassified documents coming out of the State Department, the covert action in the Congo from 1960 to 1968 was the largest covert action in the world on the part of the United States.
Mm.
So the centrality of the Congo has been consistent throughout history, modern history, let's say. And not only do the enemies of Africans recognize that, but our former freedom fighters understood that. Look at Frantz Fanon, for example, in speaking about the Congo. He acknowledged its centrality. He said, famously stated that the continent was shaped like a pistol, and Congo was that trigger. And if you pull that trigger, it sets off a combustion that would ignite the entire continent. None other than the continental father of Pan-Africanism, Kwame Nkrumah, wrote a book entitled The Challenge of Congo, where he saw Congo serving as the capital of his United States of Africa and serving as the economic engine for the industrialization of the African continent. And he had established an agreement with Lumumba that Congo would serve as such. So there has been a battle in the heart of Africa, because it's the arguably the most strategic part of the continent. We're talking about a country the size of Western Europe, an estimated 70 million people, one of the largest on the continent. Talking about a country where you can project power to any part of the continent, ideally from the Congo. And it's the only country on the African continent that is bordered by 9 other African countries. So whatever happens in the Congo, it reverberates throughout the continent. So it's not by accident, we believe, that this story does not get telling that it deserves. And there are several reasons for that. One, U.S. Implication and involvement. The enemy in the Congo has been U.S. foreign policy, not the Chinese, or it's not the Muslims or Islam, as you saw in Darfur, where they were able to point their finger at the Chinese support of the Sudanese state, or Islam being the religion that was embraced by the state and used against so-called traditional Africans. So U.S. interests have been involved at stake in the Congo from day one. You talk about coltan, for example, and how important it is to our daily lives. Another key mineral that's not often mentioned is cobalt. And cobalt, Congo has the largest reserves of cobalt, the largest producer of cobalt. Our cell phones, the batteries in our cell phones wouldn't work without cobalt. Our modern cars, electric cars, like a Prius, for example, require cobalt. The color in a television require cobalt. There, in the late 1970s, there was an uprising in southern Congo in the Katanga province. They called it the Shaba 1 and Shaba 2 uprising. And a strange thing happened. There was a shortage of color television in the United States at that time. Reason being, the supply of cobalt was interrupted. So cobalt is vital to our electronic devices and home appliances, but also to U.S. military and aerospace industries.
Yeah.
Amnesty International recently published a report. They talked about child miners mining cobalt by hand in the Congo and how that's connected to our iPhones. So they launched a campaign to get Apple to clean up its supply chain. So a few years ago, the Financial Times published an article in relation to Congo's the U.S.'s largest investment in the Congo, $2.5 billion investment by the Arizona mining firm Freeport-McMoRan in the Tenke-Fungurume mining concession, where it stated in the Financial Times stated that it was one of the top 20 terrorist protected sites that the U.S. has. It was on the list of the U.S. top 20 protected sites for against terrorism. Mm-hmm. So U.S. interest is part of the reason why, if we just scratch the surface, you'll see how the U.S. has been implicated, and the journalists and media have been reluctant to address this matter. And I'll give you one example that occurred in the debate the other day, not this week, but the previous debate, when Donald Trump said that he would arrest Hillary Clinton if he became president, or at least try and incarcerate her. And the follow-up to that, the media was outraged. They say, what is Donald Trump talking about? What does he think? Does he think this is the Congo or something? The Congo kept coming up as a reference to what happens there. But as these reporters talk about the negative side, or associate Congo for lack of democracy, they fail to mention that it was the United States who upended democracy in the Congo.
Right.
The overthrow of Lumumba wasn't just a question of the overthrow of an individual, but the U.S. systematically uprooted the democratic forces inside the Congo. And not only did they uprooted the democratic forces inside the Congo, they assured that nothing would sprout afterwards by imposing Mobutu, Joseph Désiré Mobutu, on the Congolese people for another 3 decades. And not only did they impose them, but they maintained them in power. So if you're going to tell the story of lack of democracy in the Congo, you have to tell a U.S. story, because the U.S. is deeply implicated and at the root of the lack of democracy that we find in the Congo today.
So it's so interesting that you tie in so well the role of the U.S. And, you know, very often when people talk about the Congo, they talk about the story of the minerals on the one hand, and then they talk about the violence and the atrocities and the genocide that have occurred. But on this anniversary, this 20th anniversary of the invasion of the Congo, can you tie together for us those two things? You know, how is this anniversary, what happened 20 years ago in terms of Uganda and Rwanda going into Congo, how is that related to the minerals and what's happened since then?
Wow, that's a big question. Probably the best way to go at it is to look basically what happened. The United States wanted to get rid of Mobutu, who they had installed for over 3 decades. There was a burgeoning nonviolent pro-democracy movement inside of the country. Now you would think the quote-unquote greatest democracy on the planet would want to support that nonviolent pro-democracy movement, but it's not something that they could control. So what they did instead was to back an invasion of the Congo by their allies, Rwanda, led by Paul Kagame, and Uganda, by Yoweri Museveni. Angola was involved for its own strategic purposes initially, and Burundi. And there were even some Tanzanian contingent in terms of the planning and all. But it was primarily a Rwandan, Ugandan operation. And that fit neatly in the what would later become a U.S. policy toward the region, where they grounded in what they called the Entebbe principles. When President Clinton visited Africa in 1998, he had a meeting in Entebbe, a gathering of leaders, where he, Secretary of State at the time, Madeleine Albright, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Susan Rice, came up with certain principles, the Entebbe principles. And they identified what they would later call Renaissance leaders of Africa, or a new breed of African leaders, which would include Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia, for example, Paul Kagame of Rwanda, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda. And the U.S. would provide military aid, financing, training, intelligence to these leaders. And they all came to power through the barrel of a gun. They were authoritarian figures. They invaded other African countries, and they had the blood of millions of Africans on their hands. And what the U.S. would do would cleanse the crimes that they commit locally on the international scene. by running diplomatic and political interference in international bodies like the United Nations, by putting their stamp of approval on these leaders, which they do to this day. Paul Kagame, who's the United Nations said may have committed genocide in the Congo, is very close with Bill Clinton. That's why many Congolese are concerned when the Clintons get back in power that it'll be open door policy for Paul Kagame. Kagame's got close ties with Tony Blair. When a Rwandan official was arrested in the United Kingdom because of international arrest warrants, there are four international arrest warrants on the top 40 Rwandan officials, it was Tony Blair's wife that came to the defense of this Rwandan official. He has Kagame and has friends, and not only in the political circles, but also in the economic circles. Howard Buffett, the son of billionaire Warren Buffett, who's got about $140 million invested in the region, is a key supporter of Paul Kagame and took out a one-page ad in the Washington Post a few years ago when Paul Kagame was sponsoring militias in the Congo that were displacing people and looting the resources. And Howard Buffett defended him in the one-page ad and wrote a commentary in the influential magazine here in Washington, Foreign Policy, with Tony Blair. The both of them, they co-wrote articles to support Paul Kagame. So what happens is that these leaders in the region that have kept the region in a death trap for the past 20 years, they have strong support on the outside by billionaires and former presidents and prime ministers. And this is a major part of the reason why the conflict has gone on as long as it has, because there hasn't been any accountability, there hasn't been any justice, and there's been rampant impunity. And that has been facilitated by these individuals and the U.S. Government. That's why we say that there is a battle for the heart of Africa. And unfortunately, though, it's happening in relative obscurity. And that's why the Pan-Africanists, progressives, Black Lives Matter, we need to rally around the Congolese people, especially in the upcoming couple months, because one of the products of this 20-year invasion is a president, Joseph Kabila, who came out of the rebel movement. And according to Congo's constitution, he used to step down on December 19th, and he refuses to do so. And the Congolese people are putting up fierce resistance with little or no support or solidarity from the outside. The youth gave up four dozen of their lives in January 2015 when they got in the streets and demonstrated against Joseph Kabila's attempt to stay in power. They lost another 50 or so in September 19th of this year in getting in the streets and resisting the imposition of Kabila. And between now and the end of the year, they plan to be in the streets again. So we're appealing to Pan-Africanists, the Black Lives Matter, progressives, peace-loving people, justice seekers, people of goodwill throughout the globe, to join the Congolese youth in what they call the Telema movement. Telema is a Lingala word, which means stand up. So we're calling on people throughout the globe to stand up with the Congolese as this battle for the heart of Africa unfolds. It's not just a battle around the Congo. You know, Che Guevara famously said in 65 when he went to the Congo, Congo's problem is not just a Congolese problem, but it's a world problem. That's what we're sharing with people today.
We actually have a clip from your Saturday conference. I think it's it may still be Milton Alamadi or one of the other panelists talking about Kabila. We'll go to that now.
Kabila is a creation of the U.S. So as Congolese are fighting, right, there are industries that are being killed. What they are actually saying to the people and to the world that they want to control the affairs of the Congo. They want the leaders chosen for the Congolese to come from the Congolese by the Congolese. They don't want Washington to decide that or London, and they are mobilizing. And that is the noble fight that the Congolese people are fighting. It's been 20 years. It's so long for so many people to die while the world remains silent. I'm very confident, as I see the actions of the youth on the ground in the Congo today, that they will bring an end to this conflict, and we shall see peace in the Congo. And I hope I can go home soon. I'm also itching to go back in off the ground so that we can have a peaceful Congo very soon in my country.
So that actually wasn't Milton Alamadi, it was one of your other guests, but I want you to kind of just react to what he was saying.
Yeah, that's Kambali Musavuli, our spokesperson. I want to say something quickly, you know, Kambali talking about peace and making an appeal that related to what Professor Horn stated. He stated two things that we should really take note of. He talked about the attempt on the part of the U.S. and Belgium to prevent black folks from connecting with Congolese. And he also talked about the solidarity efforts on the part of Haitians in the 1950s and 60s in the Congo. And solidarity is so critical. It's so key. It is Raoul Peck who developed the film Lumumba, who pretty much probably everybody in your listening audience have seen. If they haven't, they need to see the film Lumumba. He's a offspring of the Haitians that had gone to the Congo. It was through his parents' experience, and he may even have been there as a child, that he came in communication or in touch with the Lumumba story. And as a result of this solidarity effort, we see that he later produced one probably the best film to date on the life of Lumumba, basically the cinematic equivalent of Aimé Césaire's brilliant play, A Season in the Congo. So here it is that we have, you know, Peck joining his Caribbean counterpart from Martinique to produce classic work around the Congo that we can all draw from today to inform our education and to inform our organizing and to inform our solidarity around the very vital area on the African continent.
Thank you. You're listening to Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, and this is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. So we're going to go to a brief break right now, but before I go to the break, did you have any thoughts on our discussion so far, Gerald?
Very illuminating. And obviously this connects with the presidential election. I was just reading the Washington Post about the think tank National Security Establishment, which, believe it or not, feels that Obama has been too weak-kneed with regard to U.S. interventionism. What's interesting about this Washington Post article this morning, Libya is never mentioned in this article. And what they're saying is that if Hillary Rodham Clinton is elected, the gloves are coming off. So we can expect early confrontations with U.S. imperialism in other countries. And certainly, as Maurice Carney says, I think Congo is going to be in the crosshairs.
I find it so frustrating to even pay any attention to what is being put out in mainstream media because, for example, in this recent debate, when they talked about the coverage of the debate and how the big story was how Trump wouldn't recognize, he might not recognize the election results. But there was no mention of Hillary Clinton doubling down on this no-fly zone in Syria. I mean, this is just a calling card for World War III. There's not, you know, and then when you talk about a no-fly zone, it goes back to Libya again. And we know what happened to Libya. It's in total shambles. We witnessed the murder of a head of state on YouTube, you know, and so I just find that the whole, I think someone I spoke to recently just talked about how when empires are at their end, they become so desperate. Mm-hmm, and they talked about South Africa. They gave that as an example. And they compared what's happening to us right now to South Africa, that it, to them, it's the same type of death spiral. But anyway, thank you for chiming in. And so when we come back, we'll have, we'll renew our conversation with Maurice Carney and Gerald Horn.
Promets aux frères et des races de leur élever la tête, de regarder en face une affaiblière qui promet la délivrance. De richesse, de grandeur, c'est désormais tienne. De richesse, de grandeur, c'est désormais tienne. Ils sont les défaits dans un ciel sans couleur. Ils chalèrent étouffrant des crayons brillantes. Désert de ma terre, même lutte des ancêtres. Martyrise la tyrannie, risque de le mettre. La terre mère, terre que tu portes au cœur. Et tu feras du Congo, des terres prospères.
On a tous deux droits, on ose tous nos voix. Des orfaits de la justice,
au nom de la justice.
Avant qu'on s'écourant, debout au même rang. on réclame la justice.
Au nom de la justice,
on a tous le droit, on hausse tous nos voix. Qu'elle soit faite la justice.
Au nom de la justice,
avant ces courants, debout au même rang, on réclame la justice.
Ouais, des cendres, c'est parti à tous les vents du ciel. Et tu bâtis jadis les temples funéraires où dormaient les bourreaux d'un sommeil éternel. Poursuivis et traqués, chassés de tes villages, vaincus en des batailles où la loi du plus fort. En ces siècles barbares de rap, de carnage, signifiait pour toi l'esclavage ou la mort. Tu t'étais réfugié en ces forêts profondes, où l'autre est mort, qui était sous son masque fiévreux, oh, sous la dent du falin, ou dans l'entrée du monde. Et froide du serpent, écrasant peu à peu. Et puis s'en va le blanc, putain. Plus sournois, putain. Plus risé, putain. Et rapace qui échangeait ton or pour de la pacotille. Violent tes femmes, et livrant tes guerriers. Par contre, ces vaisseaux, tes garçons et tes filles. Les dames, dames pour donner de village en village. Pourtant, au loin le day, c'est mon les désarrois. Visant les grands départs ou les lointains rivages. Où les cotons et Dieu et le dollar roi, merde. Bill. Yeah.
On a tous le droit, on hausse tous nos voix. Qu'elle soit faite la justice.
Au nom de la justice.
Avant ces courants, debout au même rang, on réclame la justice.
Au nom de la justice.
On a tous le droit, on hausse tous nos voix. Qu'elle soit faite la justice.
Au nom de la justice.
Avant ces courants, debout au même rang, on réclame la justice.
No way.
Condamne nos travaux forcés, comme une bête, mon frère.
Welcome back to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam, in conversation with Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, and Professor Gerald Horn, visiting us today in studio. And we're talking about the Congo. This is the 20th anniversary of the invasion of the Congo in 1996. And it's also Congo Week, and it's an action to show solidarity for the people of the Congo. In the last 20 years, up to 10 million Congolese people have been murdered, have been systematically slaughtered, and up to 1 million women, girls, boys, and some men have been sexually brutalized. And this is not in the news, but we are taking our entire show today to talk about it because it is so important in terms of the international struggle for social justice, for human rights. And if no one else is going to talk about it, we have to talk about it here. We're your station for jazz and justice, and this is our job. This is what we're supposed to be doing. And so that's what we're doing this morning. So, Gerald, earlier we were talking about Syria and Aleppo. There was a comment by one of the panelists from Saturday's forum talking about Aleppo. And I think I mentioned in the last segment that the biggest story coming out of the debate was Donald Trump's failure to say that, you know, he'd accept the results of the election. But I was actually more alarmed by this whole Hillary Clinton doubling down on wanting a no-fly zone in Syria. And I just want you to kind of just talk about the Clinton Foundation, you know, which kind of has ties to both Haiti, which we're talking about, and the Congo. And before we do that, I mean, I have a, we're running out of time. But so I wanted you to just kind of maybe help us conclude by talking about that, kind of tying our discussions together.
Well, USA Today reported this past Tuesday upon the very curious circumstance whereby corporations who wanted deals through the U.S. government and the State Department would then make deals with the Clinton Foundation. And I think one of the most scandalous aspects of this scandal-ridden presidential race has been this Clinton Foundation and the role of one Hillary Rodham Clinton. But you mentioned incoherence with regard to U.S. foreign policy as imperialism enters what is hopefully its terminal stage. And you here had the spectacle of Hillary Rodham Clinton saying that Vladimir Putin could possibly rig the U.S. election. But of course, Donald J. Trump is saying that the U.S. presidential election could be rigged, but yet he is beaten down as a result. Now, which one is it? I mean, Putin can rig the election from 10,000 miles away or not. But it's not only that, but the United States, of course, interferes in elections all the time. That never comes up. Nor did it come up, to connect this back to Africa, the so-called Muldergate scandal of the late 1970s, 1980s, when the South African apartheid regime interfered in the elections of the United States, helping to defeat Senator Dick Clark of Iowa, who had helped to block U.S. imperialism intervention in Angola post-1975, 1976, or the ongoing scandal of the National Democratic Institute, National Republican Institute, these two Washington-created creatures that routinely pour money into elections in Eastern Europe, Latin America, and all over the world, helping to shape elections. So once again, the incoherence is really bubbling to the surface.
Maurice, we only have a few more minutes, so I wanted to know if you had any closing thoughts on our topic today.
Yeah, just quickly on the Clinton Foundation piece, what was particularly interesting for us are the WikiLeaks leak on the Podesta emails. And one set of those emails talked about how Podesta was working with the Rwandan or Clinton Foundation, Podesta was working with the Rwandan President Kagame to set up business ventures in Rwanda, or facilitate investment in Rwanda. The foundation has been one of the strongest supporters of President Paul Kagame, giving him awards and providing a platform for him and presenting a picture to the world that is wholly unbalanced. Mm-hmm. So the connection of the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton officials or those who were involved in the Clinton administration, to Paul Kagame, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, and the death trap that we see in the Central Africa, in the heart of Africa, is still very much alive today, and that's been one of the major obstacles to peace in the region. But quickly closing, just wanted to say that for the listening audience, between now and December 19th is critical. A tremendous amount of action taking place on the ground, particularly among the youth and in the Telema movement. That's T-E-L-E-M-A. We encourage you to support this movement inside of the Congo. It's as important as the Black Lives Matter movement is here in the United States. So you can go to T-E-L-E-M-A.org and a series of action items that can be taken. But we need immediate support, immediate solidarity. Between now and December 19th, which is the most critical period for the future of the Congo.
Give that website.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, give that website once again, and we're going to have
sure.
to shut it down.
TELEMA.org. TELEMA.org. Lingala word, which means stand up. So we're calling on you to stand up and stand for the Congolese youth.
All right. Thank you so much, Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, and my other guest, Professor Gerald Horn, in studio today. And special thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella. And thank you for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach our show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Raise your voice out there. Peace.
the theme.